that he wasn't able to join us here today. He did very much want to be here, but has asked me to serve on the task force as interim designee until we do have a new Deputy Commissioner of Financial Institutions at the department. Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy has served on this task force in the past, and his last day at the Commerce Department is actually tomorrow. He'll be retiring, and we're going to throw a nice going-away party for him on Thursday if anybody's interested. So, but wanted to first just let folks know that this is an issue that's very close to the commissioner's heart. He grew up in a situation of poverty, and the way he puts it, he grew up in the projects of Minneapolis in a family with a single mother who went to college on a federal grant while she was raising her children, and they actually moved into a single-family home when the commissioner was in elementary school on a HUD loan. And the way he puts it is, you know, this is just an issue that he cares very deeply about. And since we do have a relationship with financial institutions and a statutory responsibility to protect consumers, work with consumers, and work with financial institutions, this really is inherent to the mission of what the Department of Commerce is all about. So when I came in as Assistant Communication Director, in February, the commissioner asked me to begin working on financial literacy initiatives. And the first thing we did was call together a financial literacy roundtable, where we brought in 60 stakeholders from financial institutions, nonprofits, government agencies, state legislators, to first find out what is already happening in the state of Minnesota, and second, ask those folks for their input about how the Minnesota Department of Commerce can be helpful in that effort. And we recognize that there's a lot of good work happening already in Minnesota. I see a lot of familiar faces out in the audience of folks who we've been meeting with over the last several months and have just been incredibly impressed with the amount of good work that's already happening in Minnesota. So if you folks could pull out your financial literacy roundtable report, this is a report that the Commerce Department put together following our roundtable meeting. And the first thing we did during the month of April, which is Financial Literacy Month in the state of Minnesota, is ask the governor to proclaim April to be Financial Literacy Month in Minnesota. So the letter is included that the commissioner and Deputy Commissioner Kevin Murphy sent to Governor Dayton, and he issued that proclamation. Also included is a letter that we sent to all of the folks who we asked to participate in the Financial Literacy Roundtable, and a list of participants. And you can see, looking through the report, just how many people did come to the roundtable. We really had just an unbelievable response. We invited approximately 30 people initially, but my phone kept ringing and my email inbox kept filling up with more and more people who wanted to participate in the roundtable. So we had to move it to a bigger room, and that was a good thing. So, but if you're just kind of curious about who attended, you can check out that list. Now, if you go to the summary of stakeholder recommendations on page 11, this kind of summarized some of the conversation that we had during the roundtable meeting. And so these are all the recommendations that we got from the folks who were at the roundtable. And I want to really make a distinction between those recommendations and the 12-step action plan created by the Commerce Department, which starts on page 15. And so that's what I'd like to go over right now is the 12-step action plan. These are things that the Commerce Department has identified that we can do right now with existing resources and existing staff in the near term. So if you allow me just to go through these step by step, and if anybody has any questions following the presentation, I'd be glad to take any questions. So first, we'd like to continue the commissioner's and the department's aggressive commitment to timely, relevant consumer alerts. And if anybody's been watching the press alerts or the newsletters that we've been sending out from the Commerce Department over the last 10 or 11 months, every time we issue an enforcement action or every time we see a relevant opportunity, if there's a natural disaster, say, in North Minneapolis, flooding that is being projected in the spring, we're trying to be proactive in getting information to consumers about what they can do to prepare themselves financially for these kind of events or to protect themselves from any kind of scams or prevalent frauds that we see in the marketplace at this particular time. Another opportunity that we're exploring, we've just relaunched a brand new website at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. And we designed it to be more user-friendly, more consumer-friendly, more business-friendly. So the information and resources that the Commerce Department has available are more easily accessible, and I encourage you all to take a look at the new site. As part of that new website launch, we heard a great need in the roundtable conversation for a central place where Minnesota consumers, Minnesota organizations, Minnesota financial institutions can locate information regarding financial literacy. And that's not only tools and resources, but it's also even just dates, a calendar of events for folks who are interested in financial literacy efforts to access all that information online. We're in the process of gathering information from stakeholder groups and identifying what we'd like to put on that clearinghouse of information, and hope to have that financial literacy clearinghouse online by the end of next year. We're also improving the department's outreach efforts to senior citizens. The commissioner has already started a speaking tour going around to community centers, senior centers, and other places where seniors gather throughout the state, and delivering presentations on consumer-related issues that are specifically geared at seniors. We plan on ramping up that effort in the near term. I'll get into that in just a minute. We've also begun engaging in discussions with financial institutions and professional associations about how to partner with public and private interests to enhance the cause of financial literacy in Minnesota. You know, the Credit Unions Network, we just met with them last week. We've had some interest from Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. We've had interest from Wells Fargo, the Independent Community Bankers, Minnesota Bankers Association. A lot of folks very interested in working with the Department on financial literacy initiatives. So that's very exciting, and those are relationships that we'd like to pursue further and identify areas that we can really partner public and private resources. I know many of you are probably aware of the fact that Hopkins has kind of, spearheaded an initiative to ensure that every student that graduates from Hopkins Public Schools takes a personal finance course. And one of the teachers from the Hopkins School District who was responsible for that initiative visited the Financial Literacy Roundtable meeting. And he had a really great idea that we're working to explore with some of the financial institutions, and that is that when students in Minnesota complete a personal finance course, he'd like to explore the idea with the financial institutions that they would be given a certificate of completion that could potentially be redeemable at banks and credit unions for some kind of incentive to become part of the banked population. So it's an idea that we are interested in looking into, we'll be looking into that as well. The Commerce Department is also interested in more actively participating in financial literacy organizations and events, including the Ladders Out of Poverty Task Force, including the Jumpstart Board, including the Minnesota Financial Fitness Network, and the Commissioner has already personally participated in a number of events over the last several months, including speaking to a number of students at the Personal Finance Decathlon at the Federal Reserve Bank in Minneapolis. He participated in the annual Jumpstart event that happened just a few months ago. He spoke to students participating in the Surviving the Game Conference in Minneapolis in association with the Minnesota Lynx, which is just a great organization. He spoke at the Lutheran Social Services Financial Advocacy Awards banquet. And he's asked staff to actively participate in groups like this and groups with a similar mission. And we plan to continue to expand our involvement in financial literacy activities and organizations. We're also in the process of putting together an interagency work group on financial literacy with all of the state agencies that currently work on financial literacy programs, including the Department of Human Services, the Department of Higher Education, the Department of Education, DEED, Labor, and any other state agency that might be interested or have resources available to contribute to this effort. That includes the Department of Revenue as well. So that effort is ongoing. We're also working on improving outreach to communities of color and immigrant populations. And initially, we're primarily going to do that through media outlets that primarily target immigrants and populations of color, including Insight News, Hmong Times, the Somali media areas, to provide culturally competent consumer alerts to those populations based on some of the predatory practices that we've seen are most prevalent in those communities, and provide consumer tips to help them avoid becoming victims of such scams. We're also looking to explore legislative initiatives that could advance the cause of financial literacy in Minnesota, and some of those conversations have already taken place between Commissioner Rothman and Representative Lanning and other legislators with interest as well. And so in the legislative interim before the next legislative session, our government affairs staff are exploring legislative recommendations of the Legislative Commission to End Poverty. We'll also review the Ladder of Poverty Task Force recommendations that come from this group and explore other policy ideas that might increase financial acumen and security of Minnesotans. We're also going to continue the Department of Commerce's leadership capacity and Slice of Spring events. And for those of you who aren't familiar with this particular event, every spring, all of the state agencies get together and do kind of a financial literacy training component for state employees, where we bring in financial experts to help talk with state employees about their benefits, about their investment plans. And the Department of Commerce has always taken a leadership role in that effort. And it's something that we heard from the Financial Literacy Roundtable participants.
We will be happy to ask.
Okay.
Financial literacy, start with your own people and make sure that the folks who are employed by state government understand the benefits that they have and the financial resources at their disposal. Also, we heard about the need to continue hosting Financial Literacy Roundtable meetings. Folks found it helpful to get everybody gathered in the same room, and I know that there are other organizations that are working on that kind of collaboration. But we did recognize that there were some folks in the room who didn't necessarily know that somebody else in the room was working on a similar initiative. And a number of connections were made at that Financial Literacy Roundtable, and many ideas shared that have really kind of helped move the ball forward. And I want to reiterate that the Department of Commerce recognizes, again, that there's a lot of good work happening on financial literacy already. We're not here to take over. We're here to help and be a facilitator where necessary and help in any way we possibly can. And the last thing I'd like to point out before I just talk about one other thing is that we're working to improve our state and federal partnerships on financial literacy efforts. The commissioners had personal conversations with Skip Humphrey, who now leads the Federal Office of Older Americans, on opportunities to partner on consumer outreach to senior citizens in particular, and what resources might be available for the federal government to improve those programs. We've also been meeting directly with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, in particular on student loan debt and efforts to educate students on what it means to take on student loans. And we've also had conversations with the Federal Reserve Bank and the U.S. Treasury. And we're looking for other opportunities to partner with the federal government and take advantage of whatever resources are available. Finally, as far as personnel goes, we've never had anybody at the department focus primarily on financial literacy. And the department or the commissioner has recognized that we need a consumer outreach and community relations person dedicated to this work. So when I took over as communications director just about a month ago, I was asked to put together a new position description for the person who would then take on the assistant communication director role. So first of all, the new assistant who starts this Thursday, 25% of her time will be dedicated solely to financial literacy communication-related needs. And we are also bringing on a director of outreach and community relations who will also be focused on financial literacy efforts primarily by traveling across the state, talking directly to consumer groups, providing consumer tips, training sessions, and information seminars about financial literacy topics, how to avoid becoming a victim of a scam, and how to navigate today's marketplace. So those are two exciting announcements. We really want to dedicate the time, staff, and resources to make sure that the Department of Commerce can be as helpful as possible. And I'll be continuing to work on this initiative as well, as will the new deputy commissioner, who will come on sometime after December here. So very excited to be participating in this important work. And this is, again, something that's very close to the commissioner's heart, something that's close to my heart. And we're very excited to work with everybody in the room and to work with the members of the legislature like yourself, everybody here at this table, to move the ball forward and give people the tools and education they need to succeed in today's marketplace. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Well, thank you very much. That very helpful background and update as to where things are at with your department. And questions from members?
Well, thank you. And I'm sitting here thinking I'm at both ends of the spectrum here in my life, in my district, and I'm thinking of the financial literacy, the need for that, that you say Hopkins is it, has, mm-hmm. and in the schools that I represent in my district, those students, and I have grandchildren, a 14-year-old, I have 17 grandchildren, so, you know, they span the, you know, I've been in college and in high school, and I don't think they know how to write a check. Or any of those things, and so I think that's an important piece that we need to look at, and I suppose that would have to, you know, some sort of legislation go through our education policy, and so I think that to me it's very necessary. And then I think about, I'm at a meeting again the other evening, and my friends who are, I'm 67, they're 67 to 70, bringing me things they get in the mail. And I'm glad my friend from the Attorney General's office is here too, because what is the purpose of the no call? When you call in, and does the Commerce Committee back up when we call and want to be taken off the list of scammers trying to come after our Medicare money and trying to get us to invest in another scam or another policy? And a lot of folks that I represent are confused by that. And now they're bringing them to me at a meeting to look at them, and I'm telling them to shred it. But they want off the list. How do we get people off the list and keep them off the list? And I'll ask you if you have the power to do that, and if you have also some legality.
Well, Mr. Swenson or Mr. Pritzy, either one of you want to respond to that.
Okay. I'm not exactly sure the answer to that question, but I think, does John Reich know the answer to that question? If not, we can get back to you, Representative Fritz. Because I do know that we did have authority at one time over the Do Not Call list, but I'm not exactly sure of our regulatory authority in that area at this point. But does John?
Mr. Prickley?
Mr. Chair, if I can add, I don't believe we have the authority over the Do Not Call list, but unfortunately what we see a lot are people just ignoring people that get put on there, and there are some loopholes that allow people with an prior existing relationship, and then that list gets sold, and our office sees daily examples of people who are on a do not call list who get called, who get mail solicitations, and we tell them the same thing that you do, is simply shred this information. And I think we're seeing at the point now where it's almost sometimes getting on one of these lists doesn't really even slow things down as far as solicitations go. And it is a problem that we see every day.
And just to follow up, and the problem that I have with all of that is that it's time-consuming to my constituents to have to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And it's an anxiety that they don't need at their time in life. And so, you know, if there was some more, I would think, education perhaps, and more information shared more often, I think that's where I'd like to see some action, and then not just sit back and, you know, say, well, it is what it is, there's nothing we can do. No, I do think that we do need to address it, and so that my constituents feel that someone in authority is actually listening to them and paying attention to them, so they can have less anxiety over that issue. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Other questions? I want to mention that Commissioner Rothman and I have talked about co-hosting a meeting with representatives from the various financial institutions to explore some possibilities with a cooperative effort with them on further addressing the issue of financial literacy. So we're looking forward to doing that probably early in the year. Look forward to those conversations. I want to give anybody in the audience who has a particular information or suggestion that you might have for the task force relative to financial literacy initiatives, if you would care to come forward and share that with us at this time, give you an opportunity to do that. Anybody who's got an initiative for your organization or group that is addressing that issue or any suggestion that you might have for the task force, we would welcome that at this time. Anybody? Welcome.
Thank you.
You better identify yourself for the tape. And
I'm Andrea Furstam from Greater Twin Cities United Way. And a couple things. One, we met with Mr. Swenson and Commissioner Rothman and others last week, and one of the things that we put on the table was the opportunity for potentially some core competencies and some clear benchmarks for the state of Minnesota around financial literacy. And so that was one thing that we discussed that I think would be a value add and aligns with where the federal government, their Financial Literacy Education Commission report on this as well, some of where they were headed. And then the other piece is just so that everyone's aware, one of the paths we've been pursuing with the University of Minnesota is to develop an online financial education certification program so that people can, in human services and people pursuing a career as a teacher in secondary education and in elementary education, can get certified to provide financial education. And so that's something that we are doing and in the process of rolling out for, I think it's 2013, but we also want to make sure that we have a means of channeling people into that program so that we have that sort of quality teaching force out there. And so, you know, to the extent that we can embed that into some of our institutions and both the coursework itself and the integration of that as well as the certification. So those are two things. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thanks to the United Way for your involvement in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone else? Yes.
Representative Lane, I think this might be the right time to do this. I'm Denise Devon, and I'm representing the Asset Initiative for the Department of Health and Human Services today. And this, I just want to thank you, Commissioner, and your work. This whole issue of financial literacy throughout the country, of course, is such an important issue. And there are curriculums that are being developed, especially that target youth who are aging out of the foster care system, runaway youth. We have curriculums that speak best to Native American people and the indigenous values. And there are some free curriculums that are very good done by the FDIC, which I think everybody here knows about. But we are working to try to do what you're doing here in Minnesota around the country and trying to do kind of a train-the-trainer model where we can get to the staff of any human service agency, to the staff in any county, and then the modules get taken to parents. And so using the FDIC curriculum or Minnesota's really good one that's been written here by LSS or a couple of them for the youth are just critical to be able to speak to where people are at.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to acknowledge that it's a big initiative nationally, and nobody has a whole lot of money to throw at it, but it's very cheap to do a good train-the-trainer model, and we're finding a lot of success.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes, please come forward.
Mm-hmm.
Please identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Dick Todd from the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, and I just wanted to point out with regard to Representative Fritz's concern, as well as the general topic of financial education in the K-12 system, that another part of the what's going on, I think, is the revision of the Minnesota Social Studies standards, which were worked on over the last year or two. And I believe they're not final yet. Is that correct, Trish? The revision is still proposed, and there's issues that we can all debate about whether they go far enough, but I would nonetheless point that say that they go further in the direction of embedding personal finance into the curriculum if they are approved, and that more so than most states, they would do it from a elementary through high school level. The high school is a good time to do it, but I think the research shows starting early in building is also useful, and the standards are one thing out there that would do that more so than we have ever done before, if they are approved.
Well, as a former social studies teacher years and years ago, centuries ago, I would welcome that. That's good that they're moving in the right direction. Anyone else? Yes, please come forward.
My name is Karen Thompson. I'm on the Jumpstart board. I also represent Junior Achievement here in Minnesota. We met Mr. Swanson as he came to meet with the Jumpstart board just in this last month, and I want to thank the council for your hard work on this topic. It's an important topic. Just a piece of information. Junior Achievement is a national organization. It is a local affiliate I work for. We utilize the help of over 7,000 volunteers that we put in the classroom to teach curriculum that encourages students to take ownership of their financial future. And so those volunteers would teach curriculum kindergarten through 12th grade that addresses financial literacy in all grades. It's a short-term curriculum that is free to the schools. So we're already doing that with about 130,000 children here in Minnesota. Wow. That's over over 6,000 classrooms, over 600 schools. So it's free, and we're expanding, and we're real excited about the change in the standards and the movement that this council is taking Minnesota. So thank you all for your work.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Szymanski.
If I may just add a comment as well. Last weekend I was at a meeting with the ag educators in west central Minnesota, and one of the things that they indicated with declining enrollments in rural schools, they're constricting their curriculum, and consumer and family education is one of the first things that goes in the rural schools. And so if there's some other methods to provide that education, you know, through volunteers or whatever, I think we should seriously explore that and somehow have that authorization built into the school's operating program that they can allow those specialists in the fields to come in and teach those programs.
Good, thank you. Anyone else on the financial literacy initiative? If not, thank you. And I would encourage any and all of you that have an interest in this to keep sending us your suggestions or keep us up to date on what may be happening on these various initiatives. So that we can be helpful if there's something legislators can do collectively or individually in that regard. Next, we want to hear from the Citizens League, Mr. Bob DeBoer. They have had a major initiative underway addressing the poverty issue, and he has some good things to tell us about where they're going with their initiative. Mr. DeBoer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Bob DeBoer, Director of Policy Development for the Citizens League. And I'm going to try to, this is an untested PowerPoint, so we're going to see if
we won't grade you.
Information You know, I think grading's ingrained in your system. So I'm going to give you a little of the wider context, but we're here today to talk about an example of a prize link savings that the Citizens League is working on in Minnesota. And this is part of our larger Pathways to Prosperity project. So I'll give you a little bit there. First, for those of you who aren't familiar about the Citizens League, we're a multi-partisan, multi-issue nonprofit, been around for 60 years. We're using the word multi-partisan now because a nonpartisan doesn't seem to mean the same thing to a lot of people. And it doesn't, nonpartisan sometimes means to people you never advocate for anything. And the Citizens League does indeed advocate when we do our policy development in our appropriate way. Our vision is to create the common ground for the common good. And we have operating principles that really specifically guide our approach to policymaking that we won't get into too much today, but I'll give you just a little bit of that later on. The Pathways to Prosperity project is now going into its fourth year, and there are a lot of different facets to this project. Today I'm going to talk about a specific part of it. We've been holding workshops around Minnesota recently to kind of test people's values around some of the policy ideas we have. You know, there's a lot of expertise that goes into policymaking. But when the rubber hits the road, the people of Minnesota have to see an alignment with their values for something to really be enacted and to work. And I would say at the bottom there, our main overall conclusion so far from our Pathways to Prosperity project is that a lot of the policy we have in place is more of a reaction to poverty. And that what if we reframed this and started to think about what would we do to support prosperity? What would those policies be? How might they be different than some of the reactions to poverty that we have in current policy? So just a little bit about the project before I get into the specifics of PrizeLink savings. We want to focus on eliminating key barriers to prosperity. And our findings in our report really based on money, connections, and control. And what that really means is that sometimes to support prosperity, cash needs to be more direct in supporting activities that build capacity and prosperity in people. It's that simple. Connections is a little deeper of an issue. We all know that people need money, but we also know they need the right kind of connections and networks to succeed. Currently, our finding is that the welfare system and some of the other associated systems are really a kind of a vast pool of navigating that traps people, traps human capacity in it, and then people's energy is spent navigating that system rather than building their own capacity. And we think that that's something that needs to be changed. And then the third area is really control. There's a lot of controls built in our system that have turned into very strong disincentives to earn and disincentives to save. And we think in places where people are setting goals and working towards prosperity that we need to turn some of these things around. Some of the policies we're looking at have to do with removing asset limits, using conditional cash transfers more directly. But now getting back into our values around human capacity and civic infrastructure, we also want to find a whole network of policies that will actually work on these two things. And that's, as I said before, some of these findings, we think our current system doesn't really support human capacity. Some of the things we looked at there, you know, support asset building programs. As you're all aware, the Family Assets for Independence in Minnesota was defunded last year, but is actually the best example of a conditional cash transfer functioning in Minnesota for goal-oriented savings. People needed to put their money where their mouth was and have some goals, and then they would get matched. So we do think that is something that we need to reinstate in some way, that kind of approach. But more broadly, we think there's some new ways to reward family decision-making and progress that we really need to enact in Minnesota. And some of these are really situations where you need to build capacity where groups of families set goals with each other And that becomes our network rather than going into a professional system waiting for the response for that. We think there are people who have that capacity today in Minnesota. So really, to adopt an asset building framework is really that basic idea of, you know, we all earn money to get by, and if we're living check to check, we're getting by, and but that's not the same as getting ahead, as we all know, which is actually building assets. And the key question here, why we're focusing on savings so much, is that with a 5-year limit on most forms of public assistance, shouldn't we encourage savings for independence? I think that makes our goals a little different if we encourage savings for independence. The way I think about our current disincentives to save are this way. If I look at my 15-year-old daughter and I say to her, I want you to be independent in 5 years, so start saving money, would I then say to her, but if you save too much, I'm going to punish you? That's kind of what our current asset limits do in some of these situations. And we need to really take a stronger look at when people are really goal setting and working towards that, that asset limits don't get in the way of that. So moving on to savings and starting to talk about PrizeLink savings, and in particular the savings promotion raffle idea I want to talk to you about. We probably all have a pretty good idea of where the U.S. personal savings rate has been going in recent years. I don't know how much higher it was before 1992, but this is kind of the data I could get my hands on. I think if you go back several decades, it's probably higher, but many of you know more than I do. But either way, we have a very low personal savings rate in the U.S. So when I talk about this policy idea, it's within the framework that this isn't just about people in poverty. We all need to save more, and this policy idea is not targeted at low-income people, but it has an impact on low-income people. So let's just get a general idea of what we might think of as the four kinds of general savings products. You have savings accounts, and you have some of the things that go along with a savings account. Certificates of deposit, which most of you are probably familiar with there. And then we just talked about individual development accounts. The FAME example that we have in Minnesota is a good example of an IDA. This would be a fourth type of idea. It's a PrizeLink savings. The name in Michigan where they've enacted is called Save to Win. Now, the kind of key features there would be a low minimum entry for deposit, $25. Lower guaranteed interest rates with additional chance to win is one of the ways that this has been enacted. Monthly prizes by saving regularly so that people really start to build up that habit of savings. And then an extra draw or attraction to it with an annual grand prize. So let's go through some of the details of Save to Win in Michigan. This was the one state where enabling legislation was already in place. So the Credit Union League in Michigan, starting in 2009 with 8 credit unions, put this into place with their own resources in the Credit Union League. First of all, the $25 deposit earns the account holder a chance to win monthly prizes, up to 10 entries per month. So right away it's designed that there's a limit so that it isn't just about someone who has a lot more money can get a lot more chances to win. It's to try to promote regular savings. The financial institutions offered their prizes from their marketing budgets, and I think some of them have lower guaranteed interest rates that also put some money into the prize pool. But the difference here compared to most raffles is there's no risk of loss, other than if you were to withdraw your money, you'd lose your chance to win. But this isn't where you put some money in and get nothing. So even though because it's a raffle, it comes under gambling laws in Minnesota, I would really have a hard, if you went out to talk to people on the street, I don't know if they'd think of this as gambling since there's really no risk of loss. And here's the numbers there for what happened in Michigan in 2009 and 2010. It has expanded their number of credit unions and dollars in the pool. So really, how difficult is this idea? I mean, part of this is just making savings fun. We all know how hard it is to get the attention of people in our culture today to do something consistent and productive that they need to do. But what is happening here does seem to show that this example does bring in non-savers. 56% of all participants in a survey called themselves non-savers. They just did not have savings accounts before they started this. Also, important to us at the Citizens League, we want to check whether this tool really does get to low-income folks. And 51% asset poor, 53% lower moderate income, and 50% single parents with dependents. But this is not a silver bullet. Very interestingly, monthly winners continue to save more regularly than non-winners. So they would have, the way they structure this is a lot of small monthly prizes, and to keep that momentum going and, you know, to say, here's the month, here's this month's winner, get people excited about it is all part of it. The other thing here is that this unique model is a balance building CD. So even though someone doesn't have $1,000 to start, they can get the interest rate of a CD as they build towards that $1,000. But then, of course, if they withdraw more than once, they lose that ability. But it's an interesting product. 86% of the participants were already credit union members, so they were working out through their own networks to try to just get more savings. As I said before, it was 65% no history of a CD and 46% had no other savings accounts. So this is just some of the more data here, not to take too much time, but you know, the financially vulnerable participants, some of the numbers we just went through from the 2009. The 2009 data was their best data. That's why this is more specific. But as you can see here, 56% non-savers, 39% asset poor, and 44% low to moderate income. And this is not just state in Michigan. There have been some legislative successes around the country. In the last 2 years, a group called Doorways to Dreams is doing some of this work nationally, trying to help get states, and the Citizens League has been consulting with them some on this project. So you can see in Rhode Island, they've passed enabling legislation. Nebraska, Washington, Maryland, Maine, and North Carolina all in the last 2 years. So bringing PrizeLink savings to Minnesota, in particular, this is the savings promotion raffle. There are other types of PrizeLink products. It is low cost, and there's no government appropriation needed to do this. It does mean, though, that financial institutions would have to choose to do it and do that work to participate. Federal law does currently prohibit raffles at banks. There are other PrizeLink models that banks could use. There's sweepstakes models and other things, but the particular raffle law, there's things specifically in the Federal Reserve Act and the National Bank Act, I believe, that prohibit that. So just to give you a quick overview and start getting questions, I just wanted to get you a little bit familiar with the idea. The Citizens League, we have had legislation drafted, but have not put it in the hopper. So we could this session, but it's unclear to us what some of the dynamics are around it, so we're doing some of that work right now. I'd be happy to answer any questions about this, though.
You've already got a draft legislation. Would you be interested in having it distributed to our task force for them to?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I don't have electronic version of it, but we had a Senate counsel drafted something last year, but we did not put it in the hopper. We haven't really been looking for authors yet either. So, we were. Just in December last year was when our board approved this, so we weren't really kind of set up to go last session. And, of course, the Citizens League doesn't do a lot of lobbying, so we're not necessarily set up to make the rounds with all the committee members. But all it is, pretty simple legislation to enable this to take place in Minnesota. The way we have it written is open as far as banks and other financial institutions, but as I said before, federal law would keep banks from doing it right now.
Well, our goal here, as I think I've explained to you, is to identify initiatives that the task force thinks are worth pursuing. And and so we'd be happy to receive that, and so that the task force could consider whether or not we would be interested in having that be something to... whereas a task force, we're not going to introduce, but individual legislators obviously would introduce.
Sure.
And if we've sort of endorsed the idea here, that would certainly help. Questions from task force members? Welcome, Senator Martin.
I wish I'd brought some copies.
Yeah, well, we should have get those out. Interesting idea, though.
The only... last session we did speak to Senator Gerlach and Representative Hoppe, as the Commerce Committee would be the Committee of Origin, and so they're both familiar with the idea, and Senator Gerlach authorized the drafting, although we didn't talk about who might author it. So that's all the work we've really done legislatively.
Okay. Representative Fritz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, my question, I guess, or my comment is that of the no minimum deposit. So if you have, you know, where I come from in the working poor, who have now available to them from work direct deposit to a 401k.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, and they're doing that, but so then they're saving some money. And then what happens, what I've seen, is that they need that money. So
right.
They take it out.
Right.
And then they're broke. They don't have it. So this would be like in addition or in place of that.
Well, it could be. Now, the way it's been, at least the Michigan example, which is the well-developed one, what they did was they allowed one withdrawal during a year, and you wouldn't lose your interest for your CD. But if you did, you know, with the understanding that if low-income people are saving some money, that's exactly what it was for, you know, that $500 for that car repair or whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. But if it was twice, then they would lose the CD interest rate. But they would still, of course, still have their funds in there. Mm-hmm. And your chances for prizes are based on how much you have in there at the end of the month for monthly prizes, and then at the end of the year, if your chances for the annual prize. So if you take all your money out before the end of the year, you're not going to get the chances for the grand prize. So that's kind of how the dynamic
okay.
in there.
And what would what's the prize? Is it a $20 gift?
In Michigan, it was $100,000 was the grand
really?
Prize.
That
yeah.
much?
And the Credit Union League basically used their marketing and development money internally to create that momentum, and then the individual credit unions basically for the monthly prizes, that was the same type of approach. This monthly ones could be, you know, $50 or $100 or something like that, maybe even a little larger from time to time, but the whole thing is to have that regularity to get people in the mode of regular savings. And those who won monthly prizes were found in the data to save beyond their chances to win, even once they got in those regular saving habits.
You've answered my question. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. DeBoer? Well, thank you very much, and we look forward to getting a copy of that draft legislation, and we'll have the task force give that consideration.
All right.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to comment on this or add further information to it? Mm-hmm. Is this an idea that others have heard about?
Yes.
Well, thank you very much, and
all right.
Please stay in touch with regard to this. We'll move on then to the next series of presentations, and this is on the asset building issue, and Mr. Todd from Federal Reserve is here. Welcome.
Thank you. I'll note that I'm dressed a little casually. I hurt my shoulder over the weekend, so I'm having a little trouble dressing myself. So jackets and ties and even changing my shoes are a little difficult right now. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Thank you for this opportunity to discuss asset poverty. I'm going to try to keep my remarks simple and not too long, but I'll stress a couple points, and I think Denise will build on those after me. Two main messages. First, on the negative side, I'm going to talk about some evidence that asset poverty does indeed hurt a large percentage of Americans. On the more positive side, I'm going to argue that fairly rapid progress might be achievable because the evidence also shows that even moderate increases in household assets of the order of magnitude we just saw here are associated with significantly improved ability to weather economic stress. So another way to put it, a doable amount of near-term asset poverty reduction can take some of the worst sting out of economic insecurity while we work over time on more fundamental and far-reaching measures that would significantly reduce poverty in all its forms. I will note that the views here are my own and not necessarily those of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis or the Federal Reserve System. So asset poverty is a relatively new phrase in the social science poverty circles, but it refers to some simple and well-known facts. Poverty has traditionally been discussed in terms of income. So basically, your income is low, you're poor, your income is high, you're rich. In stressing the asset poverty perspective, scholars and advocates are looking beyond the household's annual income to consider the reserves of assets that underlie income and that households draw on over time as their income fluctuates. These assets can take many forms, obviously financial balances, but also personal and real property, social relationships, or human knowledge and human capital. So a savings account balance clearly would be a financial asset. We could also include perhaps a good credit score, which would allow you to borrow when you had trouble. Jewelry, home equity, or personal property assets. A friend or a family member who's willing to help out when you have trouble, that's a social asset. And a strong back or healthy shoulder and a clever head would be a human capital asset. Households do not draw only upon their sources of income, but also upon their reserves of those assets to provide and maintain their consumption of goods and services. They're especially important in coping with unplanned expenditures, like an emergency car repair, as was alluded to, or unexpected income or job loss. Now, in practice, much of the recent discussion of asset poverty has focused on financial assets, in particular liquid financial assets like savings account balances, and for the most part, I'm going to do that too. That's appropriate. These assets provide the most flexible and readily available means of coping with family economic stress. And surveys show that families with financial assets do indeed regard them as their first line of defense. However, I should briefly note that the surveys also support that families use the full range of assets that I've talked about. In particular, they see help from family and friends as basically their second line of defense. And many of them also consider selling or pawning property or going to work for longer hours if they can as another way of dealing with financial stress and financial unforeseen problems. And over the longest term, we should not forget that probably the surest way to address poverty ultimately in all its forms is to raise the level of human capital through wise public and private investments in education from birth through adulthood. But if we return to the immediate issue, what do we learn by looking at poverty in terms of assets, especially financial assets? So as I said, I'm going to talk about two main lessons. Asset poverty hurts a large percentage of Americans, but with even moderate increases in household assets, we can find significantly improved ability to weather economic stress, suggesting possibly a meaningful near-term progress that could be made if we move in that direction. With regard to my first point about the harm, multiple studies over the last 10 years agree that many U.S. households lack liquid financial assets that they would need to cushion the economic stresses they often face. So first of all, several studies show that people don't have a lot of liquid financial cash or savings accounts. The Federal Reserve System's own survey of consumer finance in 2007, which is before the recession, showed that over 40% of middle-income families, that's the middle quintile by income, 40% of middle-income families said their expenses in the previous year were at least as great as their income. So these households had not saved significantly in the past year, And in the lowest quintile of income, that goes up to about two-thirds, not reporting any savings in the last year. The same survey found that families, middle-income families, had low amounts of liquid financial assets. On the good side, 96% of middle-income households did have a basic account, checking, savings, something like that, but the median balance was $2,700. That's meaningful. It is helpful. I'll show that later, but it's not a lot of money. And when you get down to the lowest quintile of income, only 75% of the households had a basic account in the first place, and the median balance there was $800. So, as I say, these are useful, but they are low. Other studies confirm that many U.S. families have, you know, they basically confirm this information. One study tracked households over 2000 to 2003, very detailed data on individual households over time. A third in the middle quintile had no liquid assets, and in that middle quintile, another 30% had less than $2,000 in liquid assets. This is back in the early 2000s. At the lowest income quintile, you had 70% with no liquid assets. More recently, a 2009 study showed that about half of respondents didn't have sufficient emergency savings to cover 3 months of expenses, which is a common financial planning standard. And another 2009 study showed that almost half of Americans said that they could not come up with $2,000, you know, to make an emergency payment if they had a month to do so. So there's a lot of evidence that people don't have a lot of liquid financial assets. That wouldn't matter much if everyone's life was nice and smooth and predictable. But we know it's not, and of course the data support that. There's an ongoing study of this kind of thing that was just released last week, reporting that 1 in 5 Americans experienced a major economic loss in 2008, also in 2009, also in 2010. So through this rough time recently, about 1 in 5 have been experiencing what their definition was, a 25% decline in your income after you take account of medical expenses and debt in there too. So, but mostly it was income loss, so roughly 1 in 5 were experiencing through this period a 25% decline in pretty close to their basic income. That's a lot of volatility, a lot of stress to deal with. And this was high in the current hard times, but even back in 2004, you had 17% experiencing this kind of loss. So it's not just in recessions. And the survey of consumer finance from 2007 had some numbers that are basically similar. About 15% of families in any given year or in that year said that their income was below normal. And for those who reported that, the average deviation below normal was about 17%. That's a large drop to deal with. So we have limited assets, a lot of economic volatility. Not surprisingly, the combination is hardship. You see that, too, in the studies. From the Consumer Federation of America, Steve Brobeck reports, based on multiple surveys, these kinds of hardships for, in his case, the data are for people who had less than $500 put away. For those people, over half are concerned with meeting their monthly bill payments, and almost 30% had difficulty with basic mortgage and rent payments. Over half had overdrawn their checking account in the past year. 10% had gone to a payday lender. 10% had gone to an auto title loan. And 5% had used a pawn shop. They also report lots of worry, losing sleep, impaired health, and lost productivity at work. So these are the kind of hardships you see in those surveys. I haven't seen as much hard information on the long-term effects, but I am worried. There are a number of channels where you could see harm, long-term harm. After all, if a family can't meet its rental payment or its mortgage payment, has to move, you disrupt the children in school. We do know from studies at Cura here at the University of Minnesota that kind of instability in school enrollment is harmful to children, and we get back then into a whole cycle of poverty potentially. We know that if you can't make that auto repair that was alluded to, you might lose your job. Again, a cycle. And indeed, with the use of payday lenders, these can, you know, a really disciplined person might be able to use those effectively to handle themselves in a temporary crunch, but we do know that a number of people don't. They get caught in a cycle there too and spin downward toward bankruptcy and worse. So, you know, to summarize my first point, we do see a large number of American households have limited financial assets, and this leaves them vulnerable to significant hardship when they experience the kind of volatility that's typical in modern life. In other words, asset poverty is hurting a large share of the American population. Now, turning to my second point, and again, help to close a little more positively, many of these same studies show that improvement is possible, and even with fairly moderate amounts of liquid assets. Again, Steve Brobeck from the Consumer Federation, he found that if you looked at households that had $500 at least put away, they experienced fewer hardships. So, for example, he took low-income households that had $500 put away, and he compared them to moderate-income households that didn't. So the lower income but with $500 compared to moderate income without $500. And what he found is that the low-income people, despite their lower income, with that cushion, they were less worried about finances in general, less worried about making their housing payments, less likely to bounce a check or use a payday lender, an auto title loan, or a pawn shop. A study that based on the one that in the early 2000s that tracked people over time found that those households that had liquid assets from, let's say, a dollar up to $2,000, that was a bucket they used, the first $2,000 bucket, as opposed to having nothing. Those households had lower incidence of food insecurity, less likelihood of missing their housing, mortgage or rent payment, less likely of missing utility payment or having utilities shut off, less likely of missing a doctor visit. So even a fairly modest amount of liquid assets there was, in that study, equivalent to a fairly large increase in income in reducing hardship. And the 2009 study, one of the ones I mentioned before, found that had a little bit higher threshold. They didn't really get effect in that one, kicking in until around $1,000 and up. But still, that's not a huge amount of money, and they found increased household financial security at that level once you had around $1,000 put away. So my second point is that, you know, you can argue about exactly where it starts to kick in, but a lot of the studies show that fairly small amounts of liquid assets are associated with significant improvements in economic security. Now, I do have to caution that a simple causal interpretation here could be a little inappropriate or naive. That is, merely giving a household $1,000, might not lead to all these benefits. There could very likely, in my opinion, are some underlying behavioral and attitude differences that go along with the propensity to save and have a rainy day fund in the first place. So to get some of these positive effects, we may have to work with Mr. Swenson and everyone to get more knowledge out there, maybe work on helping people change their habits, things like that. So I'm not saying it's trivial and easy. But the amount of money we're talking about is not huge per household. It's a modest amount of money. And in that sense, I think it is doable in a reasonable time frame. And these small amounts are linked in these studies to less hardship. That is promising. If we can find the right combination of education and incentives, like Mr. DeBoer talked about, to encourage more households to keep these small rainy day funds, we may be able to blunt some of the worst effects of economic insecurity fairly quickly and at moderate cost to the public while we work on the more comprehensive long-term solutions to poverty. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Todd, thank you. That's a very helpful analysis of the importance of assets. I noticed that you were reading from
some notes here.
Could we get a copy of that?
I might need a little cleanup, but yeah, just this is weekend work. It's close to done. I can get that to you.
That rather than working fast and furiously to take copious notes here,
I can get that to you.
That would be helpful if we'd be happy to share that with those who weren't able to be here today,
right,
too, so that we would have a question.
I'll do that soon.
Questions from the task force. Senator Jungbar, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Busy time of the year for all of us, so yep. I was drawn away by many phone calls. So I haven't been actually here the whole time, but I'm wondering, in those notes, can you as well, is there links to these studies?
I have references here. Yes, I'll include those.
Okay, because that was a what year? Because I was kind of writing some of the notes. The $500 study that they came up with the $500, was that done? When was that done?
Actually, he referred to a couple studies, but they're mostly in the mid-2000s, like between 2004 and 2008.
Okay, and then the 2009, it kind of gradually went up. Is it that other study showed?
Yeah, there was another study that did have a slightly higher limit in 2009. Yeah, they didn't see the effect starting till the $1,000 bucket. But, it's as you know, social scientists often get slightly different results. But I think these are not radically different results. They're all basically showing fairly small thresholds.
Right. It was kind of exciting to hear. I mean, usually you think that somebody has to have a huge amount of assets in order to feel any kind of security. So that's I'd love to delve into, you know, what they used in that study, because it's to think $500 or $1,000 made that much of a difference to somebody.
Again, you know, I do think there may be, you know, some of the behavioral and attitude changes that go along with that are part of it.
Right.
But yeah, getting people to that point where they know how to accumulate it, how to manage it, how to use it, then they've got those skills that go along with the cash too.
Right. Great. Thanks.
Senator Marty?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought this was very fascinating as well. When you were talking about the cause and effect and the you don't want to overstate that and so on, I'm wondering if somebody who is maybe a moderate income household that has no assets, which sounds like
that
rising
happens.
Numbers
yes.
are.
And even middle and higher income households too.
But if you are taking, say, a moderate income household and the person, in other words, it could tie together. If you can somehow or another, whether through Mr. DeVore's idea of the rewarding somebody, prize and savings and so on, just the idea that once they start thinking, my goal is to put money in savings, that behavior change does it. Because, I mean, if they can put in a few bucks a month and they can get up to 500 or 1,000 or 2,000 bucks, in other words, it might be partly that they have the cushion and partly that they've learned how to
yes.
create the cushion, why you need a cushion.
I don't think the current studies tell you how to separate those two things, and it might be a combination of the two, yes.
But in your mind, from
my mind,
your
probably
guess
is
it probably would.
That's a guess. I can't prove it from the data. Right. Yeah, that's my guess. It's both the money and the habits that have gone along with getting there.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much, Mr. Welcome Todd, and we look forward to getting those notes.
Will do.
We will send those out to everyone. Denise Devan.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, he's going to help get this PowerPoint up. My name is Denise Devan, and I'm delighted to be with you today. And I'm delighted to have been asked to come from my colleagues if I could give testimony to you today. While we're passing this out, I just wanted to let you know that I come to this work with a great deal of passion, as you may know or not. I spent the first 20 years of my career working on social policy issues, so income and housing and child care and energy and early childhood, all those kinds of issues. And then the last 15 years I've spent working on this financial asset building work. And today I represent the Asset Initiative for the Department of Health and Human Services. It's a big deal that's going on. It just started. A lot of people don't know about it because it's been an internal process for the most part. And I wanted to let you know that the Asset Initiative is being launched by the Department of Health and Human Services, but HUD is quickly following along, and we have a formal partnership with the U.S. Treasury and with all the VITAS sites, so our Accountability Minnesota and the CAP agencies and others that do free tax prep, that's all a big deal going on with the U.S. Treasury right now, and that's part of our solution to find some of the emergency savings at tax time. So I want us to remember that. Before coming here today, I spent the first 10 years coordinating the FAME project here in Minnesota. And I learned an awful lot that as a middle-class person kind of scared me. This is back in 1997, 98, 99, and 2000. I had never experienced people who are staff people in human service agencies who cashed their checks at check-cashing places, people who had never banked before in their lives. And I was stunned by that. I was stunned to learn how many people were going into payday loans and all the things that you know about that our friends at Legal Services have been educating us about. I was stunned to learn how many had never banked before, were afraid of banks, had never been to a credit union. I just thought this wasn't possible, frankly. I knew in my own family there was a lack of financial literacy education. My dear mother, who died at the age of 63, died and had never balanced a checkbook. And it wasn't because she was poor. It was because that was the man's job, you know. So it was that kind of sort of background. I have a brother, Mike, who was homeless for 5 years before he died. And and yet, you know, he's still banked, you know. So there were all these kind of things that just didn't make sense. So I come to this work with a lot of passion because I have found the power of the financial literacy education that you speak about. In our initiative, there are fathers who are in arrears and are working really hard to get their credit cleaned up so that they have something to give their kids. Because any time they try to do something, it gets taken away, as it, you know, as it should, in my personal opinion. I want to offer to you that this combination of income and assets, that savings for 3 to 6 months, the match savings, and the tools that help people make that first step toward financial stability is kind of where it's at for this initiative that we're working at here with the Department of Health and Human Services. It really was Ray Bochera from the New America Foundation. He was a vice president. Now he's he works with the Federal Reserve System, Dick, in other parts of the country. But it was he who wrote this quote, "With income we get by, but it's with financial assets that we get ahead." It's that combination that Bob was speaking about here from the Citizens League. And it's Michael Sheridan who, you know, we've known about asset poverty forever. But it's Michael Sheridan who wrote this book called Assets and the Poor, 1991, a seminal book that created this concept of matched savings. He took it out of Singapore. And you should know today that in our work there are 20 countries today, Canada, the UK, Singapore, they're all listed on a couple of websites I'll share with you, that are taking the steps forward as you have done, you know, here in Minnesota 15 years ago. But Sheridan said nobody ever spent their way out of poverty. You know, he said people who escape do so through savings and investing for the long term. That's a big deal. So what I want to be able to do is I'm not going to go over the goals of the Asset Initiative, but I want you to know that the Corporation for Enterprise Development and the D2D Fund that our friends from the Citizen League spoke about are our main partners along with the U.S. Treasury. And what is my job in all this? My job is that I lead a national team of people like me that surround federal leaders. They run the Head Start program for the United States. They run the Child Care Block program for the United States. They run runaway and homeless youth. They run the child support system, about, you know, billions of dollars, TANF, okay? So I get to lead this national team, and right now, in this first year, we're focused on Head Start and child care, runaway youth, and child welfare, child support. I forgot to put fathers in here, the Healthy Marriage Initiative. But in each of these, I wanted to share with you a couple of things that might give you some other ideas of what's going on. In Head Start in Pennsylvania, they've done a train-the-trainer model where they took the financial literacy education that you spoke about, and they created 5 modules that they're doing with Head Start teachers and home visitors. And the idea is that they take those modules into those parents, and it's a really cheap way to do it, inexpensive, I should say. In child care, the child care family daycare providers in Montana and in Utah are hooking up with matched savings accounts. They're learning how to do their business plans, and they're getting banked. And these are people who have never been banked that are starting, you know, as a way to make money, right? So I'll go on from here. In runaway homeless youth, they're starting a matched savings account in Chicago, and they're going to do a dollar-for-dollar match so that these young people who have been homeless forever and cannot be reunited, if they put a dollar away, they get a dollar from a donor, and then they get into a safe rental situation. And then after that, they may get another matched savings account for education and training only. Okay, I just want to share these ideas with you. In child support, some of the states, believe it or not, are forgiving some of the fathers and or mothers who are in arrears if they will give to their children a contribution in their 529 plans or a U.S. savings bond as a gift, so that the state plans will make that possible. Among Native Americans, there are several Native American tribes that are starting children's savings accounts. So when the child is born, the tribal funds will match the savings of the parents, and it's only for education. There are many, many examples. In disability, I love this idea. These young people with intellectual disabilities are in a group home, and they'll put $25 from their job bagging groceries into their little account. It gets matched with another $25, and the whole group gets to decide together what they're going to buy for their group home, whatever it is. But then the next thing is that another match savings account for more training. All right. So HUD is coming in, public housing, and we're linking to the workforce system and CAP agencies and the faith-based and United Ways and human service agencies. Now, a lot of people, when we're into this work, they'll say, and I run into federal employees and state employees all over the country, well, what is a financial asset? I don't know what that is. And we in this room know what it is, but we simply say it's money savings, number one. Number two, it's bonds, a simple bond or stock or financial security. Or it's real property, the equity on a home or, you know, that kind of thing. Or it's machine and equipment and tools, because that's what our people need to take that next step. The intangible has been referred to, the credit or access to credit or the human capital, who you know that can help you to get ahead. Now, why do we focus on building assets? This is the research that our colleagues at the Center for Social Development have done for the past 15 years. But there is an impact economically and socially and psychologically. The well-being of children, the future orientation, the parents who believe, get this, who believe that their kid could graduate from high school and college because they have that nest egg. It's unbelievable what the research will show. We'll reference all this here. We find also that income is necessary, but alone, it just doesn't create financial stability. So we find the research will show that that it promotes long-term planning and thinking. It enhances well-being. It enhances the life chances of children. It increases the likeliness of them going to college. And it's linked to the reduced marital disillusion and domestic violence. So we'll get this research for you. It's laid out. It's pretty clear. There's also some new research on children's savings accounts that if a child has their name, just their name, and a few dollars, they're more likely to have a future orientation of going to school. We have lots of stories, and I don't want to go into that. But, of course, it's employers and governments and your policy that kind of puts the incentives this way. You all and we all know what income poverty is and where it came from. I'm not going to go into that. But the research that many have done says that asset poverty is when we don't have enough resources, I think the way it really goes, wealth-type resources to finance consumption or pay the bills for 3 months at the poverty level. 3 months at the poverty level. That's asset poverty. 3 months at the poverty level. So if you look at this next little chart we put together for you today, I like this chart because it's simple. For a family of three at $18,000, whoops, that wasn't very smart. I apologize. For a family of three at $18,000, 3 months is $4,600. Of course, for a single person, it would be just under $3,000. For a four-person family, it might be $5,500. We kind of use this generic three-person household, $4,600, to cover basic bills, basics, for 3 months. That would be not asset poor if you had that. And you'll see in the numbers I'm going to show you, the recent data that we've got is that there are many of us in the middle class that are asset poor and don't have just a minimal amount put away.
I assume that's 46 of liquid.
Liquid, yes, that's correct. Liquid, that's correct. Thank you for that. So here's our income poverty rate in Minnesota. We're a lot better than the national average. We're at 6.4%. But the asset poverty rate, now this is less than 3 months. It's not zero. It's just less than 3 months. If you add our asset poverty rate with our income poverty, we're at 20%. Our extreme asset poverty rate is a zero or negative net worth. That means there is nothing but debt, 14% in Minnesota. But we're much better, of course, than the United States as a whole. And, of course, this comes from the census right now. But if we break it down by race, and this is a thing that worries us most, or at least it worries me, and I know all of us in the room, all of our households are at 20%, you know, who are asset poor. Now, I'm just focusing on asset poverty. I'm not touching income poverty at all. Asset poverty, when you don't have 3 months of liquid resources at the poverty level for a family of three or whatever the composition is. So you can see for whites, it's 17%. Blacks, it's 58%. Latino, 42%. Asian, 21%. Native Americans, 43%. I had a Native American staffer that I worked with, and she worked in a credit union, and she worked in this asset building work, and when she got her very first paycheck, she didn't know she could deposit in the credit union. Talk about financial literacy education. She walked down the street. Her father was a pipe carrier. She had never banked before. Didn't even realize what she was doing. And she was bright. I mean bright. Marital status, household of children, of course, in Minnesota, 20%, single parent, 41%, are asset poor. Of course, we're better than the national average. We ought to be, but we have room to improve. By education, 24% of those just have a high school education are asset poor. Some college, 22%, but look at this, advanced degree, we still have under 10% are asset poor. By age, 38% under 35, 55 to 64, you can see the numbers here. Now, by household and by income, look at those who make between $20,000 and nearly $40,000 a year, 33% are asset poor. Those who make between 37 and 59, 21% are asset poor. And, of course, if you're below the poverty line, much more likely to be asset poor, right? Okay, now, I want to just say...
Chairman?
Yes, please.
On that point, I can't picture many... I can't picture half the people or 47% of people below the poverty line having 3 months of assets.
Oh, you'd be surprised, Senator.
What form? I mean, liquid assets?
This is 53% of those below the poverty line
right.
are also asset poor. And your question was... those who
but
above?
The 47%.
Ah.
I mean, it seems to me
yeah.
that, because if you say the asset level for a family of three would be $4,600.
Right.
And you're not counting things like cars or things, are you?
No.
I can't picture anywhere near that having $4,600 in a liquid asset.
Well, this is what can also be turned into a liquid asset easily, but it's not equity on a house, and it's not a car, because that's not easily transferred into liquid asset. We're finding that people have really scrunched together dollars that they pool together in their communities or in their households. We can dig into this more.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, absolutely.
Picturing household
yep.
goods, I mean, you can pawn them, but you wouldn't get much for them.
No.
Nope. $4,600 is a lot.
It's a lot of money. Well, you know, the other thing, too, is that we have a lot of people connected to the VITA sites, and they're taking some of their earned income tax credit and their state tax credits, and they're making the deposits. That's going on all over the place. But it's not enough. But it's a place where we can start.
But it starts. Yeah.
It starts. But I don't know, Senator, to your point here, if that is what the 47% is, and I will get that back to you through Greg.
Thank you.
I promise you I'll do that.
That follow-up to that question, is it in effect then that